Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. In this week's feature interview, we'll be chatting with Stephen Ridley about all things IoT. Stephen is a researcher turned entrepreneur, and he'll be along to talk about the platform consolidation we're going to see when it comes to things. Once all that settles, he argues, we'll get a better idea of the security risks we should really actually be worried about. That is coming up a little bit later on. In this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting with Simon Galbally at Senatas. Senatas, of course, makes high assurance network encryptors. And Simon joins us this week to talk about where certification schemes might be headed. Did you know there are no sunset clauses on many of the certification schemes out there? So yeah, you can be using a FIPS certified box that's riddled with known bugs, and yep, it is still certified. So maybe certifications should start moving towards a more continuous model. Simon will be along a little bit later on to talk about that. But first up, we're going to take a look at the week's security news with our good friend, Mark Pipes Piper. And Pipes, in news that came as a surprise to, I think, basically no one, St Jude Medical has brought a legal action against Muddy Waters and MedSec over the short sell against their stock, you know, involving vulnerability information. I mean, this was completely expected, you'd have to admit, right?
Yeah, and as you say, I don't think anyone's shocked. I mean, I think even MedSec were expecting it. Like, if you're listening to Justine last week, she said that they got up to third-level opinions on each of the legal matters and the routes that it may take. So, I mean, this really is sort of St. Jude doing something, because they have to be seen as doing something, right?
You just wonder how this one will play out. Do you know what I mean? Whether it'll go to court or whether or not they will, you know, walk down this road a little bit and then just sort of slink off into the into the corner after a while. Do you know what I mean? Because that's usually how these lawsuits tend to go, isn't it?
It'd be interesting. I don't know how far they'll take it, because remember that they've had the previous issues and they had the, like, you know, various federal agencies in the US looking over their shoulder and really sort of scrutinizing their actions already. So I'm not sure if that would sort of also affect on how much they want to fight this to sort of prove it, that they can back into those federal authorities that they're like, you know, in the right, in their opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably it might go away at the point that it opens them up to discovery, but we'll see, right? that's often what happens there. And hopefully we'll be bringing you all some more reporting on this next week, because that was a late-breaking story. Oh, the big news that's broken in the United States is the House Oversight Committee has launched or released its report into the OPM breach, and it's a pretty brutal read by all reports.
Yeah, I mean, it's 200 pages of, you know, how everything kind of went wrong for them, right? I had a pretty good read of the report, and it's pretty much like, you know, you couldn't have a look at box in there without tripping over malware from the sounds of it. So there's lots of interesting gems in there about the heads up they had, the previous breaches they'd had, the Department of Homeland Security saying, and US Cert saying, hey, look, there's indicators of malware on your network, and then coming back saying, by the way, now but now exfilling data off your network.
The building's on fire, you know, that sort of stuff, right? And really the big winner in this report is Cylance, however you want to say it. They you know, uncovered this whole thing during a product trial, right?
Yeah, they sort of made more sort of definitely helped paint the picture to the extent of the compromise. So they were already an OPM, they were already having a look at Cylance products and were going through that process. And there was a demonstration going on, effectively a two-week demonstration, if I recall correctly. And basically, and you know, they started finding stuff everywhere. And so your classic product demo turned into full incident response.
Like NetWitness at RSA, right? Same sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's, yeah, a lot of discussion around, you know, to what extent Cylance were involved and how they sort of helped them out between their various products for detection and prevention. And it's actually quite an interesting read from a, you know, big picture point of view as to how the entire process and how the information sort of came to light through each of the stages of the compromise and the reaction by OPM management and the reaction by OPM staff is kind of gives interesting insight into a large-scale compromise if you've never been involved with one.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing people pull out little numbers and stuff from the report showing that their InfoSec budget was, like, tiny compared to equivalent departments. And, of course, you know, it's no surprise that this report places the blame squarely on OPM management instead of anyone sort of higher up in, say, a publicly held office.
Some of the other interesting stuff in there is also about they go into sort of responsibilities. So it seems to be that there's massive confusion around who was responsible for which systems, and there's legacy environments and new environments. And, you know, it's was obviously a very complex situation at the time, and having a look at it from a hindsight perspective and retrospective perspective shows the number of bad decisions that were made, right? But I will say, I mean, one of the things that they do go into is there's effectively two breaches between 2014 and the 2012 breach, and they go into the attribution on that. And it looks like, you know, that they do a lot of work to try to say that the breaches were related to each other, whether or not it's just someone else had sort of compromised it first and then handed it off to the next team to do the exfil. And they also go into, like, you know, the names registered for the C2 domains by Deep Panda, the group they attribute the second hack to, being Avengers names and everything else. It's pretty fun read.
CaptainAmerica.evilhackerexfil.com sort of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it ends up with, like, you know, gems like this quote where they're talking about the character names used to register the C2, where they say, Dubai Tycoon, the name of the uncredited role in the Marvel film Iron Man, portrayed and noted by rapper and Wu-Tang Clan member Ghostface Killer. and I don't think you'll ever read that in another congressional oversight report.
There you go, Wu-Tang all up in your congressional reports. Awesome.
But yeah, it is a good read.
Yeah. Meanwhile, someone has finally been arrested for the breach at kernel.org, which was in 2011. This guy, Donald Ryan Austin, who's 27 now, so would have been like 22 at the time of the attack, has been scooped up and charged.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's no surprise that a hacker has been arrested for hacking. What's really interesting about this case is we have more questions than answers at this stage, right? There's very little known. It sounds like the guy was pulled over in a traffic stop in Miami or Florida and then was busted for kernel.org.
How does that happen, right? Like, well, connect those dots for me.
I would suspect that someone's been snitching, and snitching has been going on, and it's been under federal indictment and everything else, and they just reached a point where, you know, because some other legal entities become involved, they had to take action or something. Yeah. But, I mean, the indictment does give a little bit of insight into the incident. It's not much more than what we kind of suspected, which was, you know, system administrator was compromised, SSH into the hosts, and then they kind of set about snaffling more SSH credentials and moving laterally through the network to the kernel.org boxes of interest. But there's no indication of the motivation. There's no indication as to how long it was going on for. There's no real indication as to how they compromised those initial sysadmin credentials. There's no indication as to how they've picked them up to bust them. There's absolutely nothing in the indictment.
There were no suspicions that the Linux kernel supply chain was fiddled with during this attack. I mean, it's really just seems like someone going for some shenanigans, doesn't it?
I'd be hesitant to really make a judgment call on it personally, because, I mean, it does sound like, you know, good old-fashioned black hats hacking, but the scale of the response at kernel.org also kind of, yeah, you know, was one that was of interest, right? Like, they took the whole thing off for, well, at least a month while they flew around the country rebuilding data centers effectively.
Yeah.
So
right.
the response was one that was, you know, I would argue is often, the response is often proportional to the threat. So
something was going on that was beyond someone just having a bit of a play around, you reckon?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, maybe they found other actors in there, like kernel.org never really did come up with their report that they were going to drop from memory about, like, you know, full instant investigation and stuff. And presumably that's because ongoing
investigations, charges pending, court cases, blah, 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 right?
Yeah, so it'll be really interesting to see when this one goes to court and indictments are unsealed and more evidence is presented, I think.
Staying with law enforcement now, and Motherboard, Vice Motherboard, is continuing its coverage of all things sort of NIT and FBI and Tor. This is an interesting story here. I mean, one thing that's happened this year is there's been considerable discussion around the use of the so-called NIT network investigative technique. This is basically the code that FBI uses to decloak people, you know, and expose their real IPs when they're visiting things like child exploitation websites. But it turns out, too, that they used NIT against Tor Mail, which is a, you know, it's like an anonymous mail service. So they absolutely would have been decloaking people who weren't criminal suspects. This is just more reporting around this issue that's become a somewhat vexing one, hasn't it? Because it's really difficult to know where you would draw the line on the use of these types of things.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, the argument going on in court was basically like, you know, when they targeted users of the Playpen network, that you can be pretty much 100% assured that they're engaging in illegal activity. And then the argument has now switched to, well, what about that time in your own Tor mail and to collect a bunch of Tor mail users? And really, I haven't really followed Joseph Cox's work on this. I know that he's been covering it extensively. But to me, it really gets the feel that this is, you know, the FBI trying to find the boundaries of where they can go on this sort of activity and sort of setting precedent effectively, right? They've got enough convictions. Like all of the cases going through at the moment, a large chunk of them are pled guilty. A large chunk of them have failed in their defences. So they've had a pretty big win on the Playpen case, and they've caused a lot of disruption and prosecution there, right?
Well, one thing, Mark, that kind of annoys me about the way that this stuff's covered and the... You know, I think there does need to be a balance, and I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with NIT being used against something like Tor Mail. But when we start saying, and this is the thing that annoys me, when we start saying that using a decloaking tool against someone to expose their IP, when we start saying that's hacking someone, that's an issue to me because you haven't really hacked them, have you? Maybe you've used code execution, but what have you used that code execution for? And in this case, it's exposing metadata that is otherwise obfuscated. So I don't think that qualifies as being hacked. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'd agree with that assertion. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very, very valid argument, right? Like, I mean, is hacking meaning that you control the system, or are you just, you know, leaking information off the system, or how is it going through, right?
Is that system information private, or is it, you know, just the same as call record data, right? And that's how all the lawyers and all of the FBI people and all of the civil liberties people, they need to sit down and duke this one out. But it just concerns me when some of that sort of emotive rhetoric is used, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this case is them duking it out in the first phase. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I think it really is the...
It's a good one, isn't it? It's a good one to draw the line at.
Well, as I was saying, I mean, I think they've had enough wins that if they cross the line in the current cases, it's not going to affect the prosecutions they've already had, and they now have a precedent set at that point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The concern, I think, is you know, if the courts disagree with them and say, yeah, sure, you can... Go nuts. Anything and everywhere, right? Like, yeah, and we're already seeing that with other cases that with similar investigation techniques going on at the moment across jurisdictions, right? Like, this is obviously all largely focused on the US, but the decloaking data was passed out to other jurisdictions like here in Australia and various other places, right? So it's also like a larger issue around that as well.
Oh, now, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke on the show about, you know, the FBI actually doing a better job of running that Playpen child porn website because they'd taken it over and were administering it. But the FBI has actually gone to court and denied that they did anything to enhance the performance of that site. So that's just an interesting little tidbit around that whole case. Staying with the dark web, and one of the online sort of like drug marketplaces, they've banned the sales of fentanyl. And of course, this is the drug that killed Michael Jackson, very powerful sort of anesthetic slash synthetic opioid. And they've banned it, which is kind of funny because it's being written up as like, see, look at this good, you know, sort of self-regulation of a drug marketplace. But I'm guessing if I wanted to, I could still get on there and buy some, you know, crystal meth and other equally life-ruining things. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's only one marketplace, right? Like, yeah, the Darknet Heroes League or whatever it was, right? It's always been interesting, like, since back in the Silk Road, right? We always had, like, Dr. X and drug advisory and stuff. Like, I mean, it's clearly bad business if you're a drug dealer and your clientele start falling, you know, dropping off overdoses. So it's an interesting take on it. I don't think you'll see much change. I mean, it's one site.
But do you think, to me, it just sort of feels like these people running this service are trying to, okay, on one hand, yeah, it's bad for business if a few of your customers are dropping off, right? But on the other hand, it sort of feels like they're trying to operate under the illusion that what they're doing is somehow more ethical than profiting off other people's addictions. And we saw a little bit of that in the Ross Ulbricht case when he was in court. You know, there's this sort of illusion that they're these, you know, freedom warriors, right? Helping connect people with things that they should be allowed to because, hey, we're libertarians. Don't you get a sense of that as well?
Maybe they believe it. I mean, I don't know. It's always been the way, right? Like, I mean, I think if you were to go speak to law enforcement drug specialists, right, they'll say the same about the drugs being dealt on the street as like, you know, we always make sure it's the cleanest, purest, safest stuff out there, right? Like, It's just sales, really.
It is. But it also goes to a bit of, I don't know, people trying to feel better about what it is that they're actually doing. I think that's a big part of it. Motherboard also reports, and this is kind of funny, right? Because, you know, porno sites and, like, you know, song lyric sites are two places that are going to get you owned pretty quick, right? And funnily enough, one of the online porn sites, Pornhub, is actually phasing out Flash because it represents a security risk. They're rolling all HTML5. I just find this really funny when even the, you know, like the porno websites won't even use your plugin because it's a security risk. Like, it's just, it is like 2016 is weird, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this definitely ties into the bigger picture of Chrome phasing out support for Flash. Right? They came out last year, said that it was going to happen. They reiterated it earlier this year, said, like, you know, we're getting rid of that. It's too much of an attack surface. And, you know, if you're someone like Pornhub, it wouldn't surprise me if you're looking at the usage statistics of the browsers of your users and going, right, well, if it's going to affect 50% of our users or 60% of our users, then why don't we just go with the flow, right?
Yeah.
Interesting slide bit on this, right, is Adobe actually just came out, I think it was yesterday or the day before, reiterating their support for Flash and saying that they're now going to resupport it on Linux for the Nappy plugin and various other bits and pieces. So as much as people are trying to get it to die and as much as some of the larger sites out there, especially the porn sites, are going to start phasing off from it, it looks like it's still going to be around for a while on those song lyric sites.
Yeah, well, I did see that story about them reintroducing support for Linux, but I think that's because they stopped supporting it a while ago, so now everybody's using, like, completely unpatched, bug-riddled horror show Flash. So I think it's, you know, and they're just using it, right? So I think what they're trying to do is just, you know, throw a few updates at the Linux side of things while this deprecation actually occurs. So I get the logic behind that. But yeah, like one of the other porn sites, what is it, Brazzers, got owned 800,000 accounts exposed in their forum hack. Like, what planet do you have to be from to, like, contribute to a pornography forum and think that's a good idea? Do you know what I mean?
Really? Contribute to one that's powered by vBulletin as well, right? Like, I don't know. I guess people are going to be people on the internet.
Yeah, vBulletin's the WordPress of 2016, as it turns out. Last.fm got breached in 2012, and now 40 million usernames and passwords are sort of circulating. This has prompted Spotify to reset users' passwords because of reused creds, which is a nice proactive step from them. Also, 98 million passwords and email addresses leaked from Russia's Yahoo. I like how Russia has a Facebook and Russia has a Yahoo. They've got all these, like, direct equivalents. But, you know, you notice that there seems to be an awful lot of 2012 data popping up in 2016. It's become a real trend, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the two things that stand out is the number of breaches that are resurfacing from 2012 or sort of early 2013.
LinkedIn, MySpace, Yahoo, a few others.
Dropbox was a big one. But I mean, the other interesting thing is I don't understand the response from sites who are doing these password resets. They must be seeing something that we're not seeing, such as, like, you know, a large amount of accounts all of a sudden getting logins when they haven't had logins for like 2 or 3 years or something like that.
If I was Spotify, and this is probably what happened, is when the last FM data hit, you know, you'd actually go and check for those cred pairs in your database.
Yeah, no doubt. So,
you know what I mean? And then just fire off reset requests to everyone. I mean, that's become like something that forward-looking teams do these days. So,
yeah. I mean, as I say, the really interesting point for me is, like, why now, right? Why is all this 2012 data starting to appear now?
Interesting
to see if more's to come as well.
It's curious, isn't it? Rob Fuller, Mubix, has come up with a nice little USB like credential sniffer attack. It's basically a way to get network hashes out of Windows boxes by just plugging in a USB device. Basically, you just plug in a USB to Ethernet thing, and, you know, Windows being Windows, it auto installs the drivers, and then bang, you start capturing hashes and dropping malicious pack files on them and stuff. Because, you know, if a laptop's connected to a Wi-Fi network and then you give it Ethernet, it'll go through the wired connection because it's faster, right? So this is just a clever little hack.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun little hack that definitely applies a lot on physical space. Like, the amount of times that we do assessments where they're like, hey, here's the laptop as if you found it on the street. And this is the classic sort of situation where if it was, like, you know, suspended and you resumed and you wanted to be able to get creds off it, this is exactly where you would go. So, yeah, it's a fun little hack. And his blog post has a pretty good explanation on it.
Yep. Loftcracks back, man, which sort of ties into that because, you know, that's the V1, V2 NTLM hashes. Loftcrack is back. It's updated and still relevant, much to the embarrassment of the people who created it. Oh, this is an interesting story that's more of a privacy story than anything else. Also on Ars Technica, the NBA team, Golden State Warriors, they've released an official app. And it turns out it's got a lot of this, it's got some of this like audio beaconing technology in it, right? You have it in your pocket, it turns on the microphone and listens for certain coded audio waves that will tell it, tell the app and tell the app's creators where you are at a certain time if you're walking past where they're beaconing some audio so they can send you offers and things like this. Now, look, you know, we've spoken about this type of beaconing stuff on the show before, but it's super creepy. And I just think when it's one app, right, which is the edge case, it's whatever. But this stuff is becoming more and more common every day, and it's just a little bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the trend, right? Like, I mean, I don't think this is the edge case. I think this is the first one that's going to have a decent court case about it, and it'll be interesting to see what sort of the arguments are when it goes through that process. But, I mean, there's a couple of different ways that you can interact with devices, and sound has always been one of them, right? So it's not surprising, but it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Open Office is probably about to be dragged out to the back paddock and given a quick death. LibreOffice is, you know, the new Open Office, I guess, and Open Office just has been abandoned basically by developers, and it's just a bug-riddled, unupdated, unmaintained mess, and they're going to kill it.
Yeah, I found this particularly amusing because I actually thought LibreOffice was OpenOffice renamed. So it was still the news here to me was that OpenOffice was actually still a thing.
Mate, I'll be the first one to dance on its grave. I had to use OpenOffice in 1999 because I was doing an internship and they didn't have a spare license for Word. Right? So, like, I had to use OpenOffice back then, and it was the most miserable experience. One of the most miserable experiences of my life. It was that bad. And yes, let us hope it dies soon. The number of devices that are shipped with, pre-generated keys that are shared between devices, the same device by the same manufacturer, the number of devices doing that is actually on the increase, which is a bit of a concern.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting data set that came out from Set Consult. They call it the House of Keys, where they've basically done analysis of the SSL keys on devices on the internet and then figured out which ones are static across devices, which sort of manufacturers they are, how the keys can be used. There's obviously a lot of ramifications. As for the spike, they don't really go into it too much, but I mean, it's pretty much safe to say that there's a lot more devices going online where a lot of, say, with the VPN or network protection devices for home networks or small to medium businesses are buying off-the-shelf devices and putting them in. So the data set's been published on GitHub. It's pretty interesting, and I think it's definitely a statement being made to the manufacturers of these devices to sort of up their game.
Yeah, well, I'd expect the trend to be moving in the opposite direction. It's just kind of unfortunate to see that as a thing that's getting worse. Kaspersky Lab has turned up an OS X backdoor, like a Trojan, basically, which is kind of interesting. You know, we're seeing, I guess it's still the same, isn't it? The same old story with Mac malware. It sort of pops up occasionally, but it's not really causing too many dramas just yet. Google has apparently patched, another one of these massive Android bugs. Is this one a big deal, or is it just, you know, some sort of local Privesque thing like everything else that relies on a rogue app?
No, I mean, it was pretty much in line with the stage fright bugs that we've seen recently over the last sort of year or two. It could be used for remote code execution. Like the proof of concept that was put together was delivered over GChat and Gmail. Doesn't require user interaction. What I found particularly amusing about this is that basically when they had a look at it, when Google were looking at the code, they said, oh, this legacy C code is just all too horrible. So they've ripped it out and replaced it with Java. So it's the first headline you'll pretty much ever see where Java is increasing the security in that sense. But it's an interesting bug, or an interesting set of bugs, actually, I think, from the looks of it. And
it's a library. It's a bug in a library that tries to pull EXIF data out of JPEGs, yeah. Right? So, and that's pretty easy to get to, that sort of library.
There's definitely lots of routes to go there, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So more fun for Android users. Yeah, iOS 10, of course, copped an update for the NSO group, zero-day end-to-end iPhone compromise. Of course, they were, you know, they had some WebKit vulnerabilities in there that wound up affecting Safari. So there's an iOS 10 patch for that. Some critical flaws found in network management systems. These bugs, courtesy of Rapid7, and they're basically web bugs in the management interfaces for all sorts of network management stuff, as well as some SNMP stuff. But they look bad, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's all effectively, you know, dashboard takeover on your appliance that manages your network, and they're all pretty run-of-the-mill web bugs from the looks of it. But obviously, you know, depending on the target for those web bugs, you can end up in some pretty privileged places and do some pretty fun stuff. The SNMP angle is basically where they were injecting XSS via the SNMP packets, right? Was my understanding of it. So again, it was used to deliver the persistent payload so that when the web administrator logs in, you snaffle their cookie or whatever. But yeah, it's I think in line with what you expect with products where, you know, you're trying to do central management of services with a web interface.
Fortinet have been kind of dicking cert around on some bugs.
So it definitely looks like cert dropped a bunch of bugs on Fortinet and the FortiWAN product, I think it was. FortiWAN have released an update and no one's actually been able to have a look at it and confirm that stuff's been patched. So it's looks
nicely communicated, team.
Yeah, a bit of a to and fro going on there.
Yeah, so no one really knows if they're fixed.
So.
All right, Pipes. Well, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for filling in for your colleague, Adam, and I'm sure we'll chat to you again soon.
Always a pleasure.
That was Mark Piper there with a look at the week's security news. Adam Boileau will be back on deck next week. He had to disappear for a while to handle secret KiwiCon business. Both of those guys work for Insomnia Security. So yeah, if you're looking for some penetration testing, particularly in the Asia Pacific region, red teaming, stuff like that, Insomnia is a pretty amazing shop. So do give them a call. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Stephen Ridley. Stephen is well known as a security researcher, but he has specialized in recent years in embedded device hacking, actually for quite some time. It was Stephen who dropped those horror show D-Link bugs a few weeks ago. But these days, Stephen runs a startup, Senrio. And Senrio is all about monitoring IoT devices on networks, which, as it turns out, is reasonably easy to do because things on networks exhibit predictable behaviors. So it's easier to detect anomalies when something has gone screwy. Now, I know it seems like everyone is doing a talk about IoT, and I do hear and agree with a lot of the criticisms about junk hacking and so on. But Stephen actually has a real handle on this stuff and doesn't just want to scare the crap out of everyone. He joined me this week to discuss the state of play when it comes to IoT devices. It feels like, with IoT, that we're still working out what the threats actually are. You know, a couple of examples. We see a million home routers breached. We spoke about that on last week's show. But it's not really a big deal. We see some thermostats get hacked. And, you know, a demo at DEF CON on hacked thermostats. Give us bitcoins, we turn them back on. And we rightly criticize those types of things as being a bit gimmicky. Then we see the MedSec thing happen, and we realize that IoT vulnerability disclosures aren't really straightforward, like handing off bugs to Microsoft is these days. We don't know what the real risks are, and we don't understand what types of research are important yet. And this is the thing with IoT, really, right? Like, the reason we don't talk about it a lot on the show is because we don't really know quite what the issues are yet. So I started off by asking Stephen if he agrees with that summary. And a quick warning, I repeatedly say thermometer in this interview instead of thermostat. Bit of a brain glitch there, sorry about that. But here's what Stephen had to say about that summary of the state of play in IoT.
I think that's 100% on the nose. I think the industry is still figuring out, like, industry, you know, broader industry is still figuring out what IoT is going to be. It's very much Wild West. It feels kind of like, you know, like late 90s, early 2000s, when there was like stupid websites for everything. Like, you know, there was 20 different bookstores, you know.
Petfood.com, but no search engine, you know?
Yeah. It feels like that. And then there's going to be like this consolidation, like things will start to cool off and then kind of like, you know, accrete together. And then there'll be some like solid players. And I think like the protocols and the way that messaging is done between devices is going to get figured out. And then we'll kind of know what IoT is going to be. And in the meantime, InfoSec is just also kind of waiting in the balance. You know, we don't really know what the threat landscape is going to be because we don't know what the devices are going to be. I mean, even a lot of people don't know, but like, you know, Charlie Miller, Chris Vlasic, all this car hacking stuff that's happening now. When we talk about the CAN bus, you know, that's a buzzword on everyone's lips these days. CAN, as a serial protocol, actually has its origins in building automation. So the CAN serial protocol is actually used a lot in industrial control systems. And so when the technology was needed for devices to talk to one another, like the controllers in a vehicle or even in like aerospace, they went to what, you know, the closest use case, which was building automation. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff I think of when I think of IoT. And I think there's a lot of people focused on that stuff now, specifically from the security angle. But yeah, the other consumer-y stuff is still, you know, yet to be seen. We don't really know what that's going to look like.
It seems like what you're saying, though, is that everybody's creating their thing at the moment, their digital thing, in their own way. But you reckon we're going to see convergence? Because, you know, it seems like everyone's using a Linux kernel, for example. I mean, that part's all standardized, but the way things communicate isn't. So you reckon that's going to change?
Yeah, you know, we see a lot of Linux, but we also still see quite a few real-time operating systems too. So you see like VxWorks and ECOS and a lot of these really kind of what we would think of as esoteric real-time operating systems. I think there's definitely going to be some consolidation, like you mentioned. You know, even look at BlackBerry and kind of how they are, you know, really like betting big on real-time operating systems and that kind of thing with recent purchases and stuff. I think we're going to see big players like really start to kind of influence what we think of as kind of these newfangled devices here pretty soon.
So that's going to be what, protocols, or you reckon it's more on the operating system side and like actual IoT operating systems that have the protocols kind of already baked into them?
Yeah, that's what I think it's going to be. It's going to be, and this is just my own personal opinion, I think it's going to be exactly what you mentioned, which is kind of like these pre-baked solutions, more kind of geared towards development platforms for people.
Yeah, and that's exactly like you just plucked that right out of my head, because it sounds like what you're saying is eventually we're going to see like someone release the development platform for things, whether you're designing a thermometer or a whatever or this or that. It's like, you know, you've got the hardware level, here are the bits you can use, and here's the development suite that comes with it. You know, yep. You want this to talk to this, it's going to do it that way. You know, yep. Compile, off you go, deploy. That's sort of what you're getting at, right?
Exactly. Like a kind of a high level kind of modeling language for that whole workflow is probably what's going to win the day.
Mm.
But we won't see that for a while. I think
now we're going to get left behind with an awful lot of shit, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing about hardware too, is that once it's deployed, it's out there, you know, and it's really hard to like refresh fleets of stuff. So even the older stuff, it will be around for quite a long time, you know, manning mission-critical applications and stuff. So it'll be interesting.
So let's just walk through some recent news, right? So there was this botnet where there's 1 million home routers that have been infected, you know. So they're mostly using that for DOS. I'm guessing they'll probably move on to a bit of spam or something. But it's all that low-level crap that people used to do to, like, Windows ME computers, right?
Yeah.
So
yep.
Do you think we're going to see an escalation in terms of the crime types that we see applied to, say, a botnet made out of routers? Because it's kind of difficult to understand. It's kind of difficult to see how they'd sort of sneak some more cash out of that. I mean, maybe do some DNS tricks and do some, you know, divert people away from their banks and things like that. But, you know.
Yeah, for the most part, it is kind of silly stuff, like DDoSes and stuff like you mentioned, like traffic amplification attacks, stuff like that. But I think what you mentioned earlier is actually like dead on, is that, you know, it's IoT is so like weird in that it's like it has all these weird applications that these edge cases will start to arise where people will realize that there's a way to monetize specifically based on the function of that device. You know, MedSec being an example of medical devices, you know, maybe automotive will be different, right? Maybe some kind of consumer IoT might have a different play on it too. There's a lot of different ways that I think creative people will probably figure out how to monetize this stuff in the long run.
But we don't really know what they are yet. And that's why it's sort of difficult to because there are people out there, and you're definitely not one of them, but there are people out there who really talk unrealistically about the threat of IoT. And it just, I mean, it gives me the irrits. It's probably why I don't spend a lot of time covering it. You hear what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, it's actually really, you know, for us too, it's it really increases the noise, especially when we're trying to provide signal, you know, like with our product offering and the kind of stuff that we do. Yeah, the threat the threats are really overblown. You know, Dave Vitale has his famous junk hacking quote, which I think is like, you know, it's true. It really assesses kind of the state of exploitation.
What was the quote again? It was something about a toaster, wasn't it? I can't remember it now.
I think he made a joke about an automated robotic fish plaque or something, one of those.
He's made a few, because I remember once he's like, congratulations, hackers, you managed to change the preset on my toaster and burn my toast. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, I take that point, but, you know, when you see the stuff at DEF CON, which is, you know, the thermometers, right? A lot of people, I feel, missed the point of that research, right? Because they were like, they basically figured out how to update these thermometers to put a thing up on the screen saying, send us bitcoins, or, you know, we're going to heat your house to, you know, 100 degrees, right? And there's nothing you can do about it. Ha, 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 cue evil laughter. Yep. And people are like, well, you know, one bitcoin is like more than the cost of the actual devices. And it's like, okay, sure, that might be the case. But, you know, then you got to actually go get the devices. You got to go then put them in. It's a pretty giant hassle and it could happen to you again. Like,
yeah.
I sort of feel like, okay, yeah, it's a demo that was made for maximum splash and maximum headline, but it doesn't seem insane to me that someone might actually pull that off one day. What do you think?
You know, it's really hard to say at this point what those consumer device, like kind of what the real threats from those will be. Mm. I think the real stuff will be in like highly monetized, like metering applications, like, you know, the
smart meters and stuff.
Smart meters, you know, critical infrastructure type stuff, medical devices like we saw with MedSec. And I think really, and honestly, like, there's a strange thing going on too, is that especially with security consultancies where you may be consulted to do some really valuable work on a private engagement for a customer, you sign that NDA and you can't really show off the techniques you use to compromise that device. So you have to find some synonym. So you choose a stupid thermometer or something to try to, you know, display your skill. And what ends up happening is that the public information about these threats is on a device that no one really cares about. But in reality, you might have applied those techniques to something more high value, like a satellite system or some kind of telecommunications box or something. I think that's really what's happening. And that's why we're kind of seeing the lame stuff hit the conference circuit.
One thing that occurred to me, though, is the people who tend to overhype this stuff, you know, they often talk about how these things could be used as an entry onto a network. But when I look at what's happening in 2016, I mean, it's all about detecting lateral movement these days. Like, all vendors are pushing into IDR, EDR, stuff like that. Yep. You've got Haroon making money hand over fist by selling internal honeypots, right?
Yeah.
So it's all about internal networks, you know, detecting lateral movement. And, you know, at the same time, that also tells us that, yeah, you can't rely on your workstations. An attacker is always going to get a foothold on the network. So do we really care that these things are that vulnerable? We kind of have to design around that already, don't we?
You know, we've seen like some public work by folks like Rapid7 and stuff, like using printers as a way to kind of like hide out on a network and stuff. I think that stuff completely realistic. Like, I remember like way back in the day.
Oh, dude, that's old. Yeah, I mean, come on. They used to be NT4 based and it was a good time.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, remember, I don't know if you remember those old Zitami or Immatix print servers that had like FTP. They gave you like 5 or 6 megs of FTP space. You could just stash tools and stuff there on the network. Like, people were doing that for years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think even the Loft had a couple e-zines about like print server insecurity and stuff. It's like, it's really old stuff. But, you know, that's the funny thing about IoT too, is that like a lot of these old school techniques are kind of being made new again. You know, because they're using really old kernels, really like poorly secure Linux installs and stuff. And we're just kind of seeing like history repeating a little bit.
Do you think it should just give us more of a motivation to invest in better lateral movement detection on networks? I mean, is this just another driver for that?
I think so. Especially, I mean, if I'm going to zoom out a little bit and not talk about the IoT problem, I see a big trend in kind of like security these days is in micro segmentation. And there's even a few like really solid startups doing this kind of stuff, like John Terrell and Drawbridge Networks and a couple of other folks are really like focused on like leveraging network micro-segmentation as a way to prevent lateral movement.
Yeah, well, and software-defined networking is coming along, and that's either I don't know how I feel about that, software-defined networking, Stephen.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, that's also because I don't know a whole lot about it, but yeah, I definitely, it'll be interesting to see how that stuff shakes out. But yeah, I mean, I think people are thinking about that and then plugging into like endpoint solutions to like dynamically change routes and stuff using SDN. Like, I think like there is definitely people recognize lateral movement's a problem. So they're thinking, okay, how do we like contain, you know, let's assume that all the devices are compromised. Let's assume that an attacker is already in the network. What do we do next? You know, and that question mark is kind of what gave rise to endpoint security as a market. Right. And I think we'll see that kind of happening kind of to network architecture next. And it, you know, in the process, you know, IoT and devices are going to get addressed too. And so our bet, and you mentioned our company, you know, we're really focused on monitoring as a way to kind of power the solutions like that. And we're seeing other folks do it too. The nice thing is we're seeing some of our customers and people like a lot of inbound interest is around how they can use solutions like ours to kind of do policy validation. So if they are doing micro segmentation, like validating in fact that stuff is not doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, right. I mean? So making sure that things aren't popping up where they're not supposed to.
Exactly. And so like you look at the industrial control use case, you know, a lot of those guys are just, you know, these field service engineers will have that Toshiba Toughbook that talks to the PLC, but they also have like Netflix and a bunch of malware and stuff on it too. And they literally jump the air gap, plug it into the internal network, and God knows what's on, you know, that internal network now. So
it is, as Adam would call it, a nonstop porn pop-up carnival. You remember those? Exactly. I can imagine an industrial control systems engineer who never patches his machine because it might mess with his Siemens, you know, software.
Yeah,
that's going to be a gnarly laptop. That's not one you really want plugged in anywhere, is it?
Exactly. And he's alone in his van late at night on service calls.
Stop. All right. Stephen Ridley, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about the Internet of Things, ICS, and the habits of ICS engineers when they're in their vans at night.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. I love your show. Thanks for having me.
That was Stephen Ridley of Senrio there with this week's feature interview. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check out Senrio at senr.io if you're interested in that. Stephen will be keynoting the upcoming Security Week ICS Cybersecurity Conference. That one's coming up soon. And he's always doing all sorts of training. He's doing some training on ICS, SCADA, and IoT hacking. You can find information on that at automation-exploitation.com. There you go. He's a busy man. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Simon Galbally from Senatas. Senatas makes high assurance layer 2 network encryption equipment. If you need to move fairly insane amounts of traffic around and keep it encrypted while still being able to squeeze it through most telcos' hideously broken networks, then you really want to talk to Senatas because they do make awesome kit that is actually usable. Now, given where their equipment winds up, the types of customers they have, they have to get their devices certified under all sorts of schemes. And as you'll hear, Senatas, you know, they'll pay up to $500,000 just for one certification so they can sell their products to various governments. You know, it's even at the point where certification is such a big deal for them, they consult with a certification specialist, Christoph Yagi, just to make the certification process work better. Now, as things stand, Senatas, companies like Senatas, they quite like schemes like FIPS certification because they give vendors a you must be this high to enter mark to aim for. But as you'll hear, you know, Simon feels there's room for improvement, mostly because schemes like FIPS are just a point-in-time certification. So what happens if a vendor gets a tick and then a bunch of ODA gets dropped in libraries they use and they don't patch them? Does the certification get revoked? No, it doesn't. And this is the thing. Certification, again, is a point-in-time exercise, which is frankly fairly old thinking. But there is some movement at the station, as they say. Simon Galbally of Senatas joined me via Skype for this interview. Here's what he says.
What the direction seems to be is, and I think one indicator is FIPS. FIPS never had a sunset clause for any of its certifications. And this goes to your very specific point. It could be a product developed 10 years ago, given certification, and then the customer's using it now, 10 years later, and 6 vulnerabilities have been discovered in libraries or whatever and published, but that product still remains certified. And that was a weakness of FIPS versus others with sunset clauses. You know, you look at BSI, and it's got sunset clauses all over everything, the Germans, you know, possibly even Yagi argues, the gold standard of certification. So even FIPS is starting to catch up with that. What we're seeing as the trend is that, and it's been our strategy, we have a certification in-depth strategy. We use certifications not only to meet that mandated government customers' requirement in the first place, so that we can sell to US government, for example. We also use it as part of our own assessment of optimal ways, different ways in which certain aspects of our products operate.
You know, this kind of reminds me of how when you look at vulnerability scanning, right, on an enterprise network, that used to be a point in time activity. It's hard to believe in 2016 that people used to say, well, it's time for our annual vulnerability check. Do you know what I mean? To show you where issues might be. And it seems like maybe certification could move in a similar direction where it's part of a, you know, a more live process. But, you know, there's going to be inherent challenges moving to that sort of model because someone's got to pay for it and it's a lot of work. So you know, when I ask about trends, I mean, I'm kind of curious about that side of it as well. Like, what are the certifying bodies saying? Like, what are their plans in terms of, I mean, you were talking about FIPS maybe issuing sunsets, putting sunsets on certifications. That's one thing to do. But like, more broadly and philosophically, what are they thinking about doing?
Well, I'm sorry, but I can't tell you. They're a very closed set of organizations. And as you'll appreciate, and as you said, certification is a horribly expensive and time-consuming and lengthy process that has cost us, I can say, you know, as much as $500,000 for one certification. And every time we make any form of change on a product, that has to be recertified. But they don't really reveal the depth of where they're going. They may, NIST, for example, and its own thinking may talk about approaches, etc., but not in terms of the implementation side and where certification should be more visible. The direction the certification bodies may be going is driven by the pressures put on them. And there are enormous pressures put on them about these vulnerabilities discovered and certifications given at one point in time that really become irrelevant at a later point in time, and that needs to be an ongoing process. Vendors as well as customers want to see that ongoing process. However, the certification bodies really just deal with, they see themselves as dealing with something at one point in time. I think, however, as the noise that the US government itself has made about the fact that certification process isn't a real-time, ongoing process, is going to put the greatest pressure on FIPS, and they've indicated a congressional inquiry at the US government, after some of these breaches were discovered last year. There's been indication of a congressional inquiry. And I think the direction will be FIPS will be the most pressurized among them.
Well, and it's always hard to create a, you know, a certification process that covers edge cases, right? And there are so many edge cases when it comes to security. So, you know, you might cover off all of these things, you know, A through Y, and then you get done by Z. Okay, so, I mean, it is quite difficult. You mentioned the pressure. Where is that pressure coming from? I mean, is that coming from the White House? Is that coming from the, you know, the federal government departments who don't want to be OPM'd? Like, where is that political pressure on the standards bodies actually coming from?
I think it is all of the above, but it's going to vary among them by the level of embarrassment. It's like mandatory breach notification. And we've discussed that in Australia and what a disgrace that process has been and how it should cover government. I think the government, it's the administrative arm of the government, and that obviously includes the NSA, etc., who have obviously a key role in certification standards. It's first and foremost going to come from there, but agencies in particular, we've seen resignations of senior directors of particular agencies who originally said, oh, well, no one could have predicted it. I think the other thing is, among the certification authorities, they've got to look at each other's standards and maybe work together more than they do. You look at BSI. BSI is not prescriptive. It is only the approach is designed by security alone. They allow anybody to select any approach in all of the security elements of a product. Yes, that means a horrendously long process, but it allows companies to put forward their technology and show how their approach is actually highly secure.
So can you think of a certification body that's kind of looking at a more continuous rolling certification type? I mean, you know, there is a difference between putting something out there that sunsets versus something that's designed to be a live certification for a live product.
The closest example of that is probably BSI, the German Certification Authority. The closest to that.
And I got to ask, from a vendor point of view, like, do you, because I can imagine, like, it would be great to have that live certification because it probably means more to the customers, right? Yeah. But is it an epic pain in the ass to deal with it, like, compared to point in time?
The answer is it depends.
Yeah, right.
As a vendor, there's great benefit in it because it's adding value to what you do. We see these certifications as adding value. That's why we made a commitment when we built the first ever FIPS certified ATM encryptor, you know, for the US government, that we believed external evaluation of the products is a high value contributor. We've got completely different process from CAPS, different again for NATO, and different again for common criteria, non-US common criteria. Completely different. We have people who are experts in certifications. But I think the closest to that then needs to look at how does it build that into engineering departments so that there is real-time information and intelligent, practical processes to enable that, not to grind vendors' engineering departments to a halt. The other thing is, I think in terms of direction of certification authorities, they've got to be much more implementation focused. We're seeing implementations, possibly the implementation has just been, oh, these are secure devices, plug them in any way you like.
Mm.
And all these vulnerabilities are exposed. Now, you did say about our high assurance focus that, you know, that's our marketing pitch, but the thing that we say to our customers is it doesn't matter what you hang off that link, that network, and how vulnerable they are, because the only stuff passing through that router or that hybrid device, whatever it is actually encrypted to a robust standard.
Simon Galbally, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business. It's a pleasure to chat to you as always.
Good on you, Patrick. Thank you again. We enjoy sponsoring your program.
That was Simon Galbally there with this week's sponsor interview. Simon is, of course, from Senatas Security, makers of high assurance layer 2 network encryptors. And you can find them at senatas.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.